The passage that we are studying today is in the second letter to Timothy, chapter 3, and is the first paragraph, verses 1 to 9. Let me just read verse 1. "But understand this, that in the last days there will come times of stress, for men will be," etc., etc. I think it's important for us to begin here, and I want to mention four introductory points which we must notice. The first is the opening words, "but understand this," or authorized version, "know this." As I read these words, I asked myself, why was this emphatic order of Paul to Timothy necessary? Why did he tell him so clearly that he must know and understand that in the last days there were times of stress? After all, Timothy knew it very well. The existence of active opposition to the gospel was evident. Paul was writing from prison in which he was suffering from the gospel. All in Asia had repudiated Paul. Timothy had been already in the epistle repeatedly urged not to be ashamed of the gospel, but to take his share of suffering as a good soldier of Jesus Christ, because only if we endure with Christ will we reign with him. In the previous chapter 2, Paul has reminded Timothy that his ministry is going to be hampered by word battles, if he's not careful, verse 14, by godless chatter, verse 16, by stupid and senseless controversies, verse 23. So why does Paul tell him to understand what he already knows? I think the answer is that Paul affirms this because he wants Timothy to realize that this is not a passing situation, but the characteristic of the age in which he was living. Perhaps Timothy was tempted to be over-optimistic, hoping that if he lay low for a while, the storm would pass. But Paul gives him no such hope. We too should know and understand this. We should be quite clear that the Christian life is not a primrose path, but that there will be perils and troubles and sufferings to beset us in our Christian service. That's the first thing. Know this. Understand this. The second introductory point concerns the last days. For those who perhaps do not know the Bible very well, it would be natural to apply this expression to some future epoch, the days immediately preceding the end. But biblical usage won't allow us to do this. It is the conviction of the New Testament writers that the new age, which had been promised by the Old Testament, arrived with Jesus Christ. With his coming, therefore, because he introduced the new age, the old age had begun to pass away. And that means that the last days had come. Thus Peter, on the day of Pentecost, quotes a prophecy of Joel that in the last days God would pour out his Spirit. And Peter declares that this prophecy had been fulfilled. "This," he said, that is, this outpouring of the Spirit that you've witnessed, "this is what was spoken by the prophet Joel." So the last days to which the prophecy referred had come. Or again, in Hebrews 1, verse 1, we read that God, who at sundry times and in different ways spoke in time past through the prophets to the fathers, has in these last days spoken to us in his Son. So if what follows is a description of the last days, it is a description of the present, not the future. It's a description of the whole period elapsing between the first and second comings of Christ. Things might get worse in the future, as Paul suggests in verse 13 of this chapter. But already, Timothy's day was a perilous time, and Timothy was to avoid the men who are described in this passage, which shows that they're present, otherwise he couldn't avoid them. Verse 5. That brings me to the third introductory point. which is that what we are to know about the last days is not that they are uniformly, consistently perilous, but that the last days will include perilous seasons. Understand this, that in the last days there will come times of stress. And church history has amply confirmed this, that all through this present era, since the first coming of Christ, the church has met with times of stress. As the vessel of the Christian church put to sea, it did not receive, it has never received, a smooth, untroubled passage, but rather storm, tempest, and hurricane. And in these last days, then, there will be times of stress. The Greek word translated of stress or perilous means literally hard or difficult. It can either mean hard to bear, it's used of any kind of pain, physical or mental, that's hard to bear, or it can mean hard to deal with and therefore dangerous or menacing. In that sense, it's used of the raging sea and of wild animals. And it's interesting that the only other New Testament occurrence of the word is of the two Gadarene demoniacs whom Matthew describes. Like wild beasts, he says, they were so fierce, that's our word, that no one could pass that way. Matthew 8:28. So the Christian church in these last days is to expect periods both painful and perilous. Why? That brings me to verse 2. For men will be this, that, and the other. It's important to grasp that it is men who are responsible for the menacing seasons which the church has to endure. Fallen men, evil men, men whose nature is perverted, who are self-centered and godless, whose mind is hostile to God and his law, and who spread evil, heresy, dead religion, and persecution. Let's recap what we've learned so far. First, we're living in the last days. Christ ushered them in. Secondly, these last days will include perilous times as a result of the activities of bad men. And thirdly, we are to know this, to understand this quite clearly, and so be prepared for it. The rest of the paragraph is devoted to a portrayal of these men. First, their conduct, then their religion, and thirdly, their beliefs. First, their moral conduct. In the three verses which follow, verses 2 to 4, 19 different expressions are used, and it would be rather tedious if I were to attempt to analyze each separately. But I do particularly ask you to notice the first and the last. For the first says, verse 2, men will be lovers of self. And the last, at the end of verse 4, says that they are not lovers of God, as they should be. Indeed, four of the 19 expressions are compounded with the word love, suggesting that what is fundamentally wrong with these men is that their love has been misdirected. They are lovers of self, lovers of money, lovers of pleasure, instead of being lovers of God. Now, in between these four come 15 others, which are almost entirely descriptive of a breakdown of men's relations with each other. Because it is when we put ourselves first in the position where God ought to be that inevitably our relations with one another are spoiled. The first two enlarge on self-love. Men will be lovers of self, lovers of money, proud, and arrogant. The first word means braggarts or swashbucklers. We begin here because those who are arrogant and haughty, who think highly of themselves and boast about themselves, inevitably look down on others with contempt. So it's natural that the next word will be abusive, which is the RSV translation of blasphemers. they will be slanderous of other people because they have such a high opinion of themselves. The next five words, the three at the end of verse 2 and the two at the beginning of verse 3, the next five words may be grouped together, for they seem to refer to family life, and especially the attitude of young people to their parents. In the Greek, they all are negative in form, and they seem to stress the tragic absence of qualities which nature alone would lead you to expect. Disobedient to their parents, whom Scripture says children are to honor and obey. Ungrateful, devoid of elementary gratitude. And then unholy, which of course normally refers to an attitude towards God of impiety, but because of the context could refer, as it does sometimes in classical Greek, to a lack of respect, not for God, but for parents. It denotes disrespectful in this case. Next, inhuman. J.B. Phillips, utterly lacking in normal human affections. Heartless. It's part of the natural created order that parents and children should love each other, but in this case, in times of stress, there will be children who are inhuman, heartless, lacking in natural affection. And the fifth word, implacable, means irreconcilable. It describes young people who are so in revolt that they rebuff every attempt at reconciliation. They're not even willing to come to the conference table to negotiate. The relation of children to their parents ought to be marked by five things: obedience, gratitude, respect, affection, and reasonableness. But in perilous seasons, all five are lacking. The remaining seven words are wider than the family, and I need only mention them. Slanderers, that is, backbiters or scandalmongers, the sin of speaking evil against others behind their back. Profligates, or ungovernable, describes people without self-control. Fierce, or untamed. Haters of good, New English Bible, strangers to all goodness. Treacherous, a word used of the traitor Judas. Reckless, rash in word or deed, and then swollen with conceit. People with self-importance, or bumptious. And so the list ends, as it began, with pride. Now all this unsocial and antisocial behavior, this disobedient, ungrateful, disrespectful, inhuman, unreasonable attitude to parents, this backbiting, this absence of restraint, gentleness, loyalty, prudence, all this is the inevitable consequence of a godless self-centeredness. Archbishop Trench, in his book on the synonyms of the New Testament, writes of a Puritan divine who likens the selfish man to a hedgehog, because a hedgehog, rolling itself up in a ball, presents only sharp spines to those without, keeping at the same time all the soft and warm wool for itself within. In other words, selfishness always leads to bad relations with other people. If a man is proud and arrogant and swollen with conceit, of course he will not sacrifice himself to serve other people. God's order is that we love him first, our neighbor next, and ourselves last. If we reverse the order of the first and the third, putting ourself first and God last, our neighbor in the middle is bound to suffer. And so we've seen that the root of the trouble in perilous times is that men are full of self-love, utterly self-centered, as J.B. Phillips puts it. And only the gospel offers a radical solution to the problem, because only the gospel promises a new birth, a new creation, involving being turned inside out from self to unself, a real reorientation of mind, heart, and life, making us fundamentally God-centered instead of self-centered. For when God is at the center, We love the world he loves and seek to give and to serve like him. So far, then, we've spent time on the moral or immoral conduct of these men in perilous times. Now, secondly, we come to their religious observance. I think it may be a shock to us to discover that people like this, lacking the common decencies of civilized society, let alone of God's laws, could also be religious. But it's true. Look at verse 5. These men, holding the form of religion, but denying the power of it. And in the history of mankind, I fear that religion and morality have been more often divorced than married. Let me give you some examples. In the 7th and 8th centuries BC, the Hebrew prophets fulminated against Israel and Judah on this very theme. Amos was the first, and in his day there was a double boom in Israel. There was a boom in religion and a boom in injustice, in oppression, and these two went hand in hand. Come to Bethel and transgress. Come to Gilgal and multiply transgression, was the prophet Amos's sarcastic invitation. Because Bethel and Gilgal were symbols for church. Bethel and Gilgal were two of the chief local shrines or sanctuaries at which the people worshipped. And it is as if the prophet Amos said, come to church and sin. For the worshippers who frequented these sanctuaries were transgressors. Let me quote Amos again. They laid themselves down beside every altar upon garments taken in pledge. And in the house of their God they drink the wine of those who have been fined, that is, unjustly fined. In other words, in the very performance of their religious duties, they make use of garments and wine to which they have no right. Their immorality has actually invaded their religious observances. Or think of Isaiah. God says through him in chapter 1, your new moons and your appointed feasts, that is, your religious services, my soul hates. They've become a burden to me. I'm weary of bearing them. When you spread forth your hands, I will hide my eyes from you. Even though you make many prayers, I will not listen. Your hands are full of blood. Wash yourselves, make yourselves clean. Remove the evil of your doings from before my eyes. Cease to do evil, learn to do good. Seek justice, correct oppression, defend the fatherless, plead for the widow. It's all Isaiah chapter 1, verses 14 to 17. And what these Old Testament prophets said of Israel in their day, Jesus said to the Pharisees of his day. Take Matthew 23, 25. You cleanse the outside of the cup and of the plate, but inside they are full of extortion and rapacity. In other words, you're meticulous in securing the ceremonial purity of these vessels, plates and cups, while what you consume in them has been acquired by greed and dishonesty. Now, all these are illustrations of what Paul says to Timothy in verse 5, holding the form of religion, but denying the power of it. For these men, of whom Paul is writing to Timothy in perilous times, preserved the outward form of religion. They put on their Sunday best to go to church. They sang the hymns and said amen to the prayers and put their money in the offering. They looked and sounded egregiously pious. But it was form without power, outward show minus inward reality. It was piety without sincerity, religion without morals, faith without works. Indeed, while retaining the form, they not only lacked the power, but they actually denied it. It's very like Titus 1, verse 16. They profess to know God, but they deny him by their deeds. True religion, on the other hand, combines form and power. It isn't external form without power, but nor, in emphasizing moral power, does it despise or dispense with proper external forms. It combines them. It fosters a worship which is essentially spiritual, issuing from the heart, but which expresses itself through the lips and issues in moral behavior. Otherwise, it's not any valueless, it's actually an abomination to the Lord. No wonder Paul tells Timothy, avoid such people. End of verse 5. Not that we're to avoid all contact with sinners, for Jesus was the friend of publicans and sinners. And if we were to avoid contact with all sinners, we would need to go out of the world, as Paul argues at the end of 1 Corinthians 5. But what he's saying here to Timothy is that in the church, for this is a description of religious sinners, it's a description of what Bishop Ellicott calls a kind of heathen Christianity. It's a description of what the prayer book calls open and notorious evil livers. In the church, such men are to be disciplined and excommunicated. So far, we have considered their moral conduct and their religious observances. Thirdly, their intellectual beliefs. It does seem astonishing that the kind of people Paul is describing, filled with godless self-love and malice, should not only profess religion, but include some who propagate it. Verse 6, for among them, that is among these people described, among the wider category, there is a smaller category of those who make their way into households, capture weak women, women who will listen to anybody and never arrive at the knowledge of the truth, etc. The proselytizing zeal of these false teachers is portrayed here as a military operation. For they make their way into households and capture weak women. And the Greek word for capture is to take prisoner in war. Certainly their method is not direct and open, however, it's furtive, secretive, and cunning. These false teachers are sneaks. Using no doubt the back door, not the front, these tradesmen of heresy insinuate themselves into private homes. Choosing a time when the menfolk are out, presumably at work, they concentrate their attention on women. And their experience, as Bishop Ellicott puts it, is their expedient, as Bishop Ellicott puts it, is as old as the fall of man. For Satan deceived Eve first. He tackled the woman first. This same expedient was employed by the Gnostics, and it has been by many religious commercial travelers until the Jehovah's Witnesses in our own day. And the women these false teachers worked on are called little women. At least the Greek is a diminutive which expresses contempt. And we need to look at their weakness. It was a double weakness. They were morally weak, burdened with sins and swayed by various impulses. Their sins are to them both a burden and a tyrant. They're weighed down by a load of guilt and carried away by strong temptations. And the false teachers worm their way into households and play upon such weak women's feelings of guilt and infirmity. But they're not any morally weak, they're intellectually weak as well. Verse 7, they'll listen to anybody and can never arrive at a knowledge of the truth. They're mentally unstable, credulous, gullible. They're unable, notice the word, to arrive at settled convictions. Instead, they're like little boats tossed hither and thither by a storm at sea. And in this connection, they'll listen to anybody. They had a simply morbid craze for novelty. And such women, weak in character and weak in intellect, are an easy prey for door-to-door religious salesmen. As an example, Paul cites Jannes and Jambres, verse 8. The names, according to Jewish tradition, of the two chief magicians in Pharaoh's court in the land of Egypt. They are not named in the Old Testament, although one of the Targums inserts their names in Exodus 7 verse 11, where we read, Pharaoh summoned the wise men and the sorcerers, and they also, the magicians of Egypt, did the same by their secret arts. I want to ask you to notice what Paul says. He says, as Jannes and Jambres opposed Moses, so these men, the false teachers, also oppose the truth, possibly, like the magicians, practicing magical arts. But what is remarkable about the analogy is not just that the Asian false teachers are likened to the Egyptian magicians, but that Paul likens himself to Moses. For Moses was the greatest figure of the Old Testament. No prophet arose like Moses in Israel, either in his knowledge of God, for the Lord knew him face to face, or in the signs and wonders that he did to authenticate the revelation. See, said the Lord, I make you as God to Pharaoh. You shall speak all that I command you. And for 40 years Moses spoke to the people with God's words. But now Paul likens himself to Moses. As Jannes and Jambres opposed Moses, so the false teachers opposed the truth. What truth? Why, the truth of the apostolic faith. The truth that had been entrusted by Paul to Timothy, which Timothy was to guard and to transmit. Thus Paul presumes to put himself on a level with Moses, as one who also taught God's truth. Jannes and Jambres opposed the law of Moses. These false teachers of Asia were opposing the gospel of Paul. But whether it was the law or the gospel, whether it was Moses or Paul, it was God's truth which men were rejecting. And so Paul rejects them as corrupt in their mind and counterfeit, the Greek means tried and found wanting, as to the faith. And Paul is confident that such men will not get very far, verse 9. The false teaching may spread like gangrene, Chapter 2, verse 17, for a while, but its success will be limited and temporary, for their folly will be plain to all, as the folly of Jannes and Jambres came to be evident also. There's a lesson here for us, for we sometimes get very distressed, and rightly and understandably, by false teachers who oppose the truth, especially by the sly methods of backdoor religious traders. But we need have no fear. There is something patently spurious about heresy, and there's something self-evidently true about the truth. Error may spread and become popular, but it will not get very far. In the end, it is bound to be exposed, and the truth is sure to be vindicated. So now let me conclude. It should now be plain what these dangerous seasons are in the last days in which we live and how they arise. It is because in that part of God's field, the world, in which God has sown wheat, the devil has also sown tares. The devil has his fifth column actually in the church. Article 26 of the Church of England says, in the visible church, the evil is ever mingled with the good, and sometimes the evil have chief authority in the ministration of the word and sacraments. Yes, in the church, within the visible society of professing believers, are men of immoral character and conduct, men of purely external religiosity, men of corrupt mind and counterfeit faith. First, they're lovers of self, money, and pleasure, rather than lovers of God and of their fellows. Next, they retain the form of godliness, but deny its power. And thirdly, they oppose the truth and seek to win weak women to their pernicious views. Do you see, morally, religiously, and intellectually, these men are perverse. Now, why does Paul emphasize all of this? Why does he urge Timothy to know this and to understand it? Well, partly so that Timothy will be ready and not be taken by surprise. Partly so that Timothy may take precautionary measures and be on his guard. But mostly so that Timothy may adapt his ministry accordingly. That is to say, the more men oppose the truth, the more we must maintain and expound it. The more false teachers divorce religion and morality, the more zealous we must be in marrying them. And that is what Paul goes on to argue at the end in the rest of the chapter. We must never give in to these prevailing tendencies. On the contrary, our duty before God is to stand firm and to speak out. And may God give us men and women of courage and caliber to do that very thing in the prevailing tendencies to evil and heresy that there are in the church today. Amen.